everyone. Welcome to episode 81 of the Extra Sequential Podcast. My name's Mladen.
Yes, it is. My name is Chris. I'm coming from Perth. And today we are talking about meta.
Yeah, meta comics. And there's quite a few comics which are kind of about comics themselves, where characters meet their creator, as in their writer. They realize they're living within a comic. There's lots of fourth wall breaking. And there's quite a few which sort of fit that criteria, from the humorous to the mind-warping science fiction high-concept comics. And we're going to be running the gamut of these kind of meta comics. So I'm looking forward to this highbrow topic, Chris.
Indeed, I'm by the fireplace. I've got half a glass of scotch and I'm wearing a tweed jacket and there's leather patches on my elbows, so I'm ready.
Well, it's like 40 degrees in Perth now, so suffer. Before we get into the news, I'm curious if you read any comics this week.
Oh, of course. Well, I did actually read Dynamite's Tarzan. Was for some weird reason, I think copyright issues or something, they've been having troubles with the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate. But so it's actually called Lord of the Jungle, but the second issue is out now, so I read that yesterday by Arvin Nelson and Roberto Castro. But it's actually pretty good. The first issue kind of, well, it was okay, but this issue is a lot better. It features the adult Tarzan, which his first issue didn't. It was basically just him as a baby and, you know, his origin. And then in the second issue you see pirates or buccaneers, which reminds me of a good joke, Mladen. Do you know how much it costs a pirate to get his ears pierced?
Is the word
a buck an ear? Get it? Good one. That's the only joke I know.
I don't know if you're telling it right.
Pirates kidnap Jane Porter and her professor father and a few others when they're on the archaeological expedition, and they find this island and basically abandon them after Tarzan attacks the captain. It's really good art. Very mature. It's like a great kind of pulpy, mature adventure tale, if you like, the Lone Ranger series that Dynamite have been putting out. I think you really like this. So, yeah, Lord of the Jungle number 2. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I also tried to watch Danger 5. Don't know if you're aware of this, Mladen, the new...
Yeah, a new show by the creators of Italian Spider-Man or...
Italian Spider-Man. Yeah, Italian Spider-Man, the huge web series that came out a couple of years ago and it's just been seen by millions and millions of people. So they did this Danger 5, which is kind of like Thunderbirds meets, you know, kind of 60s shenanigans. But, yeah, you know, cheap sets and dodgy accents and Hitler's involved and lots of cleavage. And, yeah, I turned it off after 10 minutes. I mean, I could see what they're trying to do, but it just wasn't funny. I was disappointed, my lad. I'm disappointed.
Was it that the novelty wore off or...?
I mean, there were no jokes as such. Just, yeah, I don't... just didn't do it for me. It's very hard to explain.
Because a show which does something similar well would be Garth Marenghi's Dark Place or something.
Oh, yes, that's awesome. Or even, I guess, Venture Brothers, I guess, would be something similar, which I haven't really seen much of. But it kind of takes that high camp adventure and it, yeah, kind of mocks itself. And I guess we'll kind of get into that later. But, yeah, kind of mocks the trappings of the genre and stuff. Whereas Danger 5 almost seemed to be embracing them. And, yeah, it wasn't really funny.
Yeah, I mean,
disappointing.
There's a film called Black Dynamite, which is a similar thing as when that's like a modern blaxploitation film. But I think there's a fine line between spoof and just doing something straight. And sometimes it's funnier if you just do it straight rather than awkwardly throw in bad jokes. Or the trailer for Danger 5 was, I'm sure, was funnier than the show itself, because it's a bunch of non sequitur, you know, dinosaurs in Nazi hats and that kind of thing.
Yeah. This and also gave my speech at the library.
Oh, yeah. How did that go? Was there a round of applause?
There was, but, yeah, that was basically I was asked to, replace Keith at Quality Comics. He couldn't make it. So, basically, it was the bi-monthly meeting of librarians at the Fremantle Library. So, I had, like, 5 pages of notes, and I emailed them and stuff, and I explained the difference in comics, graphic novels, and trade paperbacks, and it was good. They really listened to me and had some really good questions for me, and I basically gave my recommendations in all different genres and brought a few examples. So I pretty much covered everything, not just stuff that I'd like, but stuff that I know would be popular and stuff that was accessible. So I hardly mentioned any superhero stuff at all. I thought you'd be proud of me, but no, it was really good. And
you didn't refer to Green Lantern, the struggle for the magic ring, as a mature all-ages title, or no?
No, I didn't. Struggle for the magic ring, no. No, I did not. Oh. Copyright. But that was really good. They've, manga's very popular and flying off the shelf and comics. So all popular. The librarians there said that, the graphic novels are kind of expanding. And I guess the main problems they had were kind of how do they classify them? Like some go into fiction, some go into young adult, some go into humour. So it's kind of interesting. And then other people just have graphic novels all in one. And a lot of the trade paperbacks apparently just fall apart because they're not made, for continual rereading. So that's an interesting issue. It was really good. And I said, more than eager to talk about comics. It's my favourite subject to talk about other than God and myself. So hopefully I'll get the opportunity to do so again. But I was quite happy to see that they're on the pulse and the comics are actually flying off the library shelves. So I guess if you haven't visited a library near you, listeners,
yeah, I've been raiding my local library for comic after comic after comic. Melbourne City Library has heaps. I recently read a non-fiction book about comics called Reading Comics by Douglas Walk. I don't know if you've seen this one. It came out a few years ago, and I thought it would be very academic and well-written, and it's neither. So that was a bit of a shame. It's like this... It presents itself as this highbrow examination of comics, but really it's more of a cursory look at American comics history during his lifetime. And he seems kind of ignorant of anything happening outside of America and barely seems to recognize anything happening outside of Marvel and DC, except the few obvious ones like, Chris Ware, the Hernandez brothers, Mouse and Chester Brown, really. It's just this weird schizophrenic book where one second he'll be bitching about how comic readers are too nostalgic and uncritically adoring everything they loved as children. And then he'll go on for several pages about what he loves about the superheroes from when he was a kid. And like a chapter about how great some one-off Birds of Prey comic is. It's a bit of a strange book. Like one second he'll be bitching about people being elitist and then he'll be the most elitist snob in the next sentence. Just really schizophrenic. I mean, it makes me realize how the comics field needs a good academic book, possibly by the Extra Sequential podcast. Yes.
I'm sure we could if we put our minds. I know C-Card have, published quite a few, haven't they, on Invisibles and
That's it. Yeah, they've been putting out really kind of scholarly work, even on their website. So it's a shame to see a book which sees print be so, cursory.
Scholarly.
Yeah, it's just a bit of a letdown, that's all. It might be handy as an introduction, but not much else. So, yeah. Other than that, I've read Lost Girls a week
ago. Ah, yes.
And that one's been a long time coming.
This is Alan Moore and Melinda.
Melinda Gebbie, his wife, I believe. Their pornographic tale of Alice in Wonderland, Dorothy from Wizard of Oz, and I'm missing one, Wendy from Peter Pan.
Peter Pan.
And their sexual escapades as adolescents.
There's a sigh there.
No, like... It's parts of it are very interesting, and then parts of it are so just obvious and a bit stupid. It was just like a bit all over the place. So if I could pick out chapters to read, there's definitely some food for thought in there and high concept ideas and drawings of penises and all that stuff you love, Chris.
I don't see that much.
You don't know. You don't, comics. Do you? Yeah, it's pretty fair. Like, it shows both sexes nude an equal amount of time, which is very refreshing. You don't see that much, do you? So,
I certainly don't.
Yeah, if you can borrow it from your library and you can stomach scenes of graphic pornography, have a read. And if you're a fan of Alan Moore, I'd say it's pretty. There's no huge surprises in his work there, but if you're put off by that kind of thing and you don't want to get caught reading it, maybe put it aside.
Oh dear! So shall we go to the news?
Let's do that. News.
Talking about Seekart, they are actually releasing an image documentary. So it's called Comics in Focus: The Image Revolution. Well, they're hoping to release a documentary. It's the same team behind Grant Morrison and the Warren Ellis documentary, which I believe the Warren Ellis one, Capture Ghosts, just had its premiere last month. So hopefully we'll see it released on DVD very soon. We'll put the link on our website, obviously. But, they're seeking funding to the tune of $11,000. So I don't know how they got funding for the other two, but I don't remember them being on Kickstarter. But, yeah, so it's a bit odd because I thought the other two documentaries would have been quite successful. But anyway, so it's actually Image Comics' 20th anniversary this year. So that would actually be a – because that's kind of one of those stories that hasn't been told. You know, seven young gun up-and-coming artists kind of meet in the Marvel, you know, canteen and decide to form their own company like that. It's quite an interesting time in modern comics history, so I'm curious to see the documentary and hopefully they get a few interviews with the original founders.
It's a story which is famous among people like you and I who are into comics history.
Yes.
But not well known outside, and I think it's, you know, just as backstabbing or, I mean, the stakes aren't as high as something like The Social Network, as in money-wise, but the kind of personalities at play and the conflicts between them is very similar to the story there if you kind of look at what happened in that company and the how quickly it dissolved as well. So, from the original core group. So is this a documentary or is it a fictionalized account?
No, it's a documentary, so there won't be any black and white, you know, dodgy footage saying dramatic reenactment. You know,
I'm Rob Liefeld.
Rob Liefeld getting in a fist fight or whatever.
Yeah. Me draw pouches, tiny feet.
They're about to begin.
Metacomics. Chris.
Yes.
When I mentioned this topic to you, what did you imagine?
My first thought was Abed in Community.
Interesting. Could you describe his character to people who haven't seen it?
Community is a pretty awesome TV show that you actually got me on Team Aladdin, and I was actually just watching the second season moments before we recorded this, but Abed, it's in a community college, and Abed is this very pop culture aware TV addicted kind of guy, and he sees everything around him as almost like being in a TV series, and he is always referencing pop culture. Yeah, so he almost sees himself as a character, and reality is like a TV show, and he's just happens to be no audience.
Yeah, he seems to be the one who's cognizant of, I think I'm on a TV show, or he's autistic enough to believe it's true. And either way, it's played for laughs and for some very high concept stuff that happens, surprisingly high concept stuff that happens on a comedy show, as I'm sure you can attest to. But in comics, I guess there's quite a few comics where they kind of break that fourth wall of, characters seem to refer to themselves being inside a comic and play with the rules within that. And there's a lot of writers who are known for frequently visiting that topic, and some which just sort of flirt with the idea. So I guess we can throw ourselves into it by dealing with the one which always comes to mind, which would be Grant Morrison.
Yep.
Now, since early on in his career, he seems to be fascinated with breaking the fourth wall and having his characters realize what they're getting themselves into. I mean, with Animal Man, his debut work for DC and Vertigo, I believe. Have you read this one?
Correct. I haven't. And it's interesting, you know, a lot of these kind of meta comics, they don't really happen so much these days, but like in the 80s and 90s, they seem to happen a lot. And I don't know if Animal Man was the main thing for that. Perhaps you'll prove me wrong with some more modern day examples, but it's a pretty bold move to take, and I think it's kind of one of those things that can only appear in comics. I'll mention Ambush Bug later, but he's certainly, if you gave Ambush Bug, which is a very fourth wall breaking character, to a non-comics reader or a new comics reader, they wouldn't see it because they wouldn't get all the references. The comics just as themselves, I guess, it just have such complex history and tropes that no other medium has. So they can kind of take full advantage of this in ways that perhaps no other characters can. But, yeah, I've always been aware of Animal Man, and I think he did kind of similar thing with Doom Patrol as well, didn't he? But
I mean, Animal Man, it was his tenure on reviving pretty much a dead character in the same way that at the same time Alan Moore was brought on to revive Swamp Thing. DC was trying to dig into the treasure trove of back catalog things, play off some nostalgia, sell some comics, but they also would give it to young up and coming writers who were willing to just and gave them
go
free
nuts.
Reign. Yeah, go
great
nuts. No one cares about this character. Go nuts, do whatever you want. And you got quite a few bizarre successes, as with Animal Man. So Morrison used it as like a soapbox to address animal rights, which I don't think was, it was a subtext in the old comic, but he went full bore. But in the later issues, it becomes clear that Animal Man realizes that he's been in limbo for the past 20 years. He actually goes to this comic book limbo, which is a real place, and all these characters are pleading to be brought back, including Mr. Freeze. And you have to remember, this comic was written prior to his return in Batman, the animated series. So it's interesting to see how characters do kind of come back out of that limbo of disuse, and Grant Morrison's been one to do that a lot.
But I think Grant Morrison revisited that idea in Final Crisis, actually. There was kind of like, this island of forgotten toys, or whatever he called it, where Superman is trying to save the universe, and he came across a pocket dimension or something that was all these kind of forgotten comic characters from DC that hadn't been seen in decades and decades.
So he revisits it. That's interesting. So he's made that part of the canon, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to reread it, but I'm going by my dodgy memory, and I'm sure our listeners who've read Final Crisis, which came out, 4 or 5 years ago, which is one of those big world-ending things that DC loves so much. But, yeah, Superman was trying – I think he was visiting different universes, and he stumbled upon these guys, which had basically – because people had stopped reading the characters and stopped being interested in them, so they almost kind of existed in this limbo.
Yeah.
They didn't exist. And, I mean, they never said that we are comic characters or whatever, but that was certainly the strong suggestion. And I think, Grant Morrison put himself – he seems to appreciate the power of storytelling and stuff, because didn't he create – he put himself, but he called it the writer.
Yeah. It's like pretty interesting the way he does it, because he – in the last issue – Animal Man does meet his writer, and he makes it clear, I'm not the only writer, I'm just your writer, and I won't be your last writer, and I won't be your first, and I control every part of your reality, kind of thing. But and it's interesting to see at that point where he can talk directly to us. He doesn't have a lot to say. His what he had to say was in the stories. He's like, I had to think of something really important to say, but I was struggling. So it was his last issue on the title. So it was like he was talking to us, the reader, as well. But there's issues before then, like there's a villain who kind of goes nuts, and then he starts summoning all the superheroes from other dimensions who've been retconned out of existence through the crisis. Infinite Crisis?
Oh, Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah, that's it. So Sunshine, Superman, and all these other ones. And he summons them to defeat the characters within... Is Earth 1 our dimension? I can't remember which one's which.
Yes, and Earth 2 is the other one. There's 52 different Earths.
Oh, that's right. Well, his thing was, they're the ones who are responsible, and he's pointing out at the panel directly at you, reading it. And then the characters say, I think I can see someone looking down on us. I mean, he plays with it in a silly way, like some of the characters break through the panels into the gutter and so forth. I mean, and in an early issue, there's issue 5 features a thinly disguised Wile E. Coyote, who strikes a bargain with his creator to escape the endless cycle of death and rebirth, of Looney Tunes cartoons into Animal Man. It's very bizarre, but Grant Morrison is known for testing just strange concepts and so forth. I mean, The Invisibles is another one where he plays with these very meta ideas. Invisibles, I'm not sure if you've read much of this series.
No, I know. Doesn't Robbie, what's his name? The singer, Robbie Williams, is that his name? He's a fan.
Ah, yeah, I think he named one of his albums after.
Because Frank Quitely did the cover art of one of his albums. Yeah,
And in that one, he had Invisibles was kind of about conceiving larger dimensions in a 3D space, and he would use the analogy of conceiving three dimensions in a 2D comic. But that comics are actually a good approximation of 4D space, because you're seeing time across the length of an entire page. You're seeing this, which is unique among comics. You don't see that in films. You're not experiencing every moment at once, and you don't see that in novels either. So that's another thing comics have going for them, as a special medium. But he's a strange one. I've been trying to think of, is there a comic where he hasn't written himself into it? Because he seems to write himself in either thinly veiled, as in the King Mob character in Invisibles, or literally in there. Or if there's a bald character, you can probably count on it's probably meant to be Grant Morrison. But we should have a think about this one. But he's kind of wonderful, very meta as a writer.
kind of reminds me when you're talking about Wile E. Coyote, there was that classic sort of Daffy Duck or Donald Duck or something episode, Donald Duck episode, I guess.
Duck-a-muck.
Or no, Daffy, where the paintbrush would come in and kind of repaint like anvils that were falling on his head, and he was kind of fighting with them, kind of talking to the painter, and you'd see like a live action hand with a paintbrush.
Mm. And changing the background and changing the genre of his cartoon. I believe that was an Academy Award nominated, if not winning, short animated film.
Yeah, because that would have been, what, in the 40s or 50s or something, so quite ahead of its time, I'd say.
I think it's one of few animated films to be put into the Library of Congress as, you know, important American cinema. So that's and you can see why. It's for especially for a children's cartoon, it's very high concept when you get past the fact that, yeah, it's just a funny idea, but the boundary of recognizing, hey, this is a fictional world and these characters know it, even though they pretend not to, or sometimes they don't know it. It's playing with those ideas, I find a lot of fun as a reader, and sometimes it's played just for laughs. I mean, there's lots of comics we could point to. Early Mad magazine would often have people breaking the fourth wall constantly. 2000 AD has an issue where all the 2000 AD writers and artists riot in the streets, and Judge Dredd has to arrest
really?
Them, placate them. Yeah, it's quite
nice.
Yeah, I thought that was a cute touch. Yeah, it's easy to play it for laughs. I appreciate the efforts to take it semi-seriously in some cases. You asked for a modern example, though. Planetary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, yes, okay.
This is a series by Warren Ellis and John Cassaday, and it ran from, I think, 2001 to 2009, although he had a hiatus due to illness, I think, somewhere in the middle there.
But are you flipping a coin or something? What are you doing, your two-face impersonation?
You'll live for now, Chris. But it's one of few books where I've noticed the superheroes actually engaged in science fiction, and it's not just set dressing, you know, having rockets and so forth. And it's about this superhero operatives who create this organization called Planetary, and they go around researching parallel Earths and superhero technologies and villain technologies and so forth, but to advance the betterment of mankind. So if there was a villain with some kind of destructor ray, they'll find a good use for it. Possibly to irrigate crops or something, you know. It's very kind of science fiction-y in that sense. I know you had a chance to read one of the stories from here.
Yeah, I read I actually just read this week an article on Comic Book Resources. Greg Burgess just wrote a pretty awesome article on Planetary, actually, which I read a couple of days ago. And it's one of those series. I've never read a lot of Warren Ellis' work, but this is one of those series that I've been aware of, and people just continually praise it, so I might have to... Yeah, see if I can get the trades at the library or whatever.
I think you'd enjoy it if, I mean, as someone who appreciates some of Grant Morrison's work, this maybe is a little bit easier to stomach, but is also intelligent enough to give you something to think about.
Yeah, and it seems to be full of Easter eggs and stuff. I remember that I think I only read the first issue, which had a Doc Savage-like character called Vic Brass or something, and they had, like, different variations of the Fantastic Four, didn't they?
Yeah,
like,
they're the villains of the piece, so these alternate evil versions of them who go through... Don't they go into some galactic wormhole and they come out with powers? He plays that as them trading the future of the Earth for these powers, and then... They go around murdering and so forth. But there's lots of other characters like Godzilla and Sherlock Holmes and the Shadow, Superman, Green Lantern, Hulk and Thor, but like thinly disguised because, remember, this is from Wildstorm?
Wildstorm imprint of DC Comics, which doesn't really exist anymore. But, I've actually got the Planetary Batman Night on Earth one-shot, the only Planetary comic I actually bought, and this came out in 2003. Again, written by Warren Ellis with art by John Cassaday, who I believe did the art for every issue, I believe. And I think every issue of Planetary had a different logo. Were you aware of that?
I didn't, but I know the covers, I don't think they ever had, yeah, you're right. It never had the name of the comic the same way every time. That's unusual, yeah.
So this is pretty cool, and the only reason I picked this up when it first came out was because they had all different variations of Batman in it, and I'm a sucker for that kind of alternate universe stuff. So basically, it centers on this guy called John Black. He's a bad guy kind of on the run, but when he panics, he basically has this device with this kind of his parents were genetically engineered or something, and he brings other alternate universes to himself. So basically, when he's running, So
it's like he's fusing all the different parallel Earths, and some people die because of it quite grotesquely. But what happens is Batman's chasing him, isn't he? And then he starts changing in between universes. It's quite interesting. Correct. Yeah,
you explain it much better than me. And so there's still a version of Gotham City in the planetary's world. So you've got versions of Dick Grayson and the Joker.
Mm.
The Joker kind of looks the same, but he's called Jasper. They look kind of like...
And he's just a guy. He's just like pale green hair.
He's pale green hair, but they're both cops, and yeah, it's kind of interesting. Basically they're chasing this guy, but Batman's chasing him as well. And yeah, this big globe kind of compasses Crime Alley, where Batman's parents were killed and Batman was effectively born. But it's pretty interesting. So they run into all these different versions of Batman. And the first one is the modern-day version. He fights Chiquita. Is it Chiquita Wagner? Is that her name? He's kind of the... one of the main three characters. And John Cassidy kind of draws all the variations of Batman in his own style. So, you know, often in stuff like this, you'll see, you know, someone will try and ape Frank Miller's style when Dark Knight Returns character shows up, whatever. But this, it's still unmistakably John Cassidy, but he
it's clear what it is, yeah. Like, you can tell he's referencing that because there's little cues like how bulky he is, but it's not like he takes on a new line style.
No, correct. That's right. So it's pretty cool. So and it's pretty funny as well. Just so there's like the 60s version of the TV show.
Oh, that's great.
Shows up, and that's just
Bat villain repellent.
That's the one. That's got to be one of my favourite panels in comics. Where
maybe next time, chum.
Yeah. he sprays Chiquita.
I never hit a girl. Yeah, it's great.
That female villain repellent, and then runs away. And the next time, it's the Dark Knight Returns, and he's just this big, wrinkly, you know, black costume hulking guy.
Yeah.
And then there's the 70s Neil Adams version, is very streamlined. And
there's the original one with the purple gloves. It's
the ones with a gun, yep. And then there's like a futuristic one. The interesting one, there's actually a disclaimer in the front, inside cover of this, saying, this book honors several versions of Batman from past eras and should be taken in the context of the time each represents. The Batman holding a gun on page 40 is the same as depicted in Detective Comics number 32 from 1939. I don't know why they felt they had to say that. Perhaps people feel, what's Batman doing holding a gun? Perhaps they didn't realise that that was actually an actual honest in continuity version of Batman. And he shows up for a couple of panels. But
I think they didn't want people writing in and saying, Batman would never do that.
True. So perhaps it was to quiet the complaining fanboys. But so the Planetary Batman Night on Earth. Great art. Planetary is, I guess, one of those ones that I'll have to look into. Speaking about Batman, there was in the late or mid-90s, there was, I think, a four-issue miniseries called Batman Black and White. They might have done two series of it, I can't recall, where they'd get black and white stories, like each issue was an anthology with a whole host of pretty creative talent. And you know what one I'm going to talk about, but there was a story written by Neil Gaiman with great art by Simon Bisley, which actually featured Batman and Batman and Joker as actors inside a comic. So they're kind of hanging around in the green room waiting for their time, and basically Joker is kind of, well, effectively an actor playing Joker. It's kind of, I guess, saying that his mum's disappointed in him that he's a supervillain, and, you know, Batman is like crashes through the skylight, you know, with the shards of glass smashing and very heroic. And later when they're walking out, you know, the Joker's jealous and says, wow, that was awesome when you crashed. I never get panels like that. So it's a very self-referential, you know, it's like the kind of just two jobbing actors posing for a comic. So that was pretty interesting. If you could pick up Black and White, it's a great series.
I don't know if is it still in print? Because they had the larger sized formats and I was lucky to get those, and then they started publishing them in the small format again.
Oh, okay. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, because the large ones are worth it. It was like, you know, it wasn't absolute size. It was a little bit smaller than that, but it was nice to see, you know, someone like Simon Bisley's artwork, which is normally, you know, very, very detailed, at a bigger size than the tiny, tiny comic format. You know, you just take in a lot more grotesque detail, which is fun.
Yeah, I wish he did more art, just interior art. He doesn't really do much comics these days, does he? Mm. I don't know. Is he still working on 2000 AD? Or?
Probably. Obviously, he does a lot of covers. I don't know. I can only remember the Raphael Casey Jones comic he did.
Okay.
And that was all interior art by him. So I'm sure there's some. Got to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Should we mention a couple of characters? rather than comics that break the fourth wall?
Well, we can, but you mentioned Batman, so I mean, there's one TV show, and it seems to be Batman attracts this, and it's probably because he's such a popular character that he attracts a lot of writers who want to be impressive. So they they try and write something very high concept.
But, and he's had many different versions, and he effectively fits into any genre, really, sci-fi, fantasy, detective, crime.
He's had a long history, which has been quite – it's still quite legible for a long history. It's not like a character like Wonder Woman who is pretty inconsistent in terms of – yeah, like Batman, you can go, this is his this period and this is his period, you know.
True.
But there's the, you know, the cartoon series Brave and the Bold, obviously.
I love it. I wish it was, yeah. I haven't caught the last few seasons. Hopefully it gets released on DVD. They did that annoying thing where they release it, you know, Series 1, Volume 1, Series 1, Volume 2, Series... just give me the whole thing.
Don't do that, because then, you know, they don't release, you know, Season 2, Volume 2. They release box set of Season 1 and 2, and then... a few months later, then Season 2, Volume 2. They want you to get that box set anyway. It's double dipping. It's evil. But
it's like putting your whole mouth in the bowl.
Hey, you're doing Seinfeld. Okay, I get it now. The final episode of the series is called Mightfall, and that's a bit of a reference to a Batmite comic from the 90s, which referenced the Batman Nightfall comic, but otherwise it's unrelated. And in it, Batmite basically gets sick of the TV show.
So who's Batmite? Batmite is kind of like an impish. He's like Batman's version of Mr. Mitzelplix.
Yeah, he's like another dimensionary, kind of a magician-ish character. But he's more like Loki, if that helps, like the trickster god. Except he's a bit more... unintentionally harmful. He's just like a child who has way too much power. He's a bit like Q. That's probably a good example for Star Trek.
Yes.
But he gets sick of the show. He thinks it's jumped the shark. So he decides to ruin it with his powers, so it gets cancelled. So he decides to make little changes which fans will hate and make them change the channel, thus killing the show. And the things that they insert as things fans hate are very much spot on. He gives Batman a wife and a child, an adorable child. He changes a fan favorite's actor's voice. So Aquaman's got a recognizable voice, and he just changes the voice actor. Little things like that. You're like, yeah, that does bug me. He inserts all the unwanted toy company tie-ins. So Batman gets around on a neon talking super street action bat luge. And he gives Batman all the, you know, the variant, horrible variant costumes you see on toys, like Arctic
firefighter Batman.
Yeah. Moves the cartoon to Malibu, California, and they're all surfing. And then he gives Batman guns right at the end. And it's very aware of the fact that the show was pretty much cancelled at this point. So fans are already tuning out. So Ambush Bug intercedes. Now, before we say what else happens, you want to quickly give me a rundown on Ambush Bug? Because I know you're...
Well, I can't give you a quick rundown, so why don't we come back to him?
Okay, fair enough. But he's a similar character to Batmite, but what's the word? Ambivalent. No, what's the word when you're not malevolent?
Anti-malevolent, yeah.
Thank you, anti-malevolent. That's the word I was looking for. But he tries to make Batman aware of what's happening, and they win, but the show is cancelled anyway. And there's a nice heartfelt ending and so forth, but it captures the show captures that mean-spirited sense of comic fans who feel entitled and complain incessantly about everything. And the show itself flirts with that idea a lot. I think in a lot of episodes it gives you little payoffs or gives you like little winks like, you thought you knew what was going to happen here, but, you know, just little strange things. And especially considering it's a show which is a loving homage to the 50s Batman, which was never popular among modern Batman fans anyway. This last episode's a nice capstone to it, but very, very meta. So you can tell it's like the writers just talking directly to you. Like, things could go way more downhill than this. Let's just leave it at this and quit while we're ahead. And, you know, move on to bigger and better things. So for a show which I've only watched here and now, you know, every now and then, the last episode's really quite I wouldn't say moving, but for someone who's invested in the show, it'd be very moving probably. But, yeah. I'd recommend if you can catch it, Chris, do it. Do it.
Oh, well, I've actually ordered the different volumes on Quickflix, actually. So
nice.
Hopefully that'll allow me to catch up. But, yeah, as... I remember the last shot of the Superman, Superman the movie, my favourite movie of all time. He winks at the camera just before the closing credits. Like, the end is very cheesy. Like, he drops off Lex Luthor and Otis at the Metropolis prison or whatever, and then flies off. And you know, the governor says, "Thank you, Superman. The world is safe again. Thanks to you." You know, and then he says, "Oh, don't thank me. I'm just." Oh, yeah, it's kind of cheesy, but done in such an awesome way. And then Superman flies off. You know, the sun's going over the earth, and then he kind of flies past the camera, and he turns to the camera and winks, and that's classic. And they did that again in the last season of Smallville, I'm pretty sure, where Tom Welling finally put on the Superman suit. But and I know a lot of writers and artists often put themselves and their own kind of Easter eggs and in-jokes into comics, especially Comic Resources, again, have done a pretty big article on different Easter eggs. Yeah, well, they'll, you know, put their, especially on the crowd comics like X-Men or Avengers or Justice League, where there's a lot of crowds of people, they'll put the writers in. I know when Superman and, well, Clark Kent and Lois Lane got married, a lot of the writers, artists, editors were kind of in the congregation watching the wedding take place. So that's pretty cool. But yes, Ambush Bug. Let's talk about Ambush Bug. This is a character that not a lot of people are familiar with. And again, I guess kind of like the Batmite, Mr. Mitzelplix characters, they don't really exist anymore, do they? I mean, it's also serious superhero stuff these days, and these characters aren't really seen too much.
They're from a lighter period, I guess.
So Ambush Bug debuted in 1982, created by Chief Giffen. And he is kind of in that Mr. Mitzelplix Impossible Man. And there's other couple that came to mind. There's Forbush Man, who was a Marvel character. It was actually a Marvel employee called Irving Forbush that Stan Lee would occasionally try out into comics. And then DC had another version called Amazing Man, which is a character that isn't used very often. But Ambush Bug is kind of, well, I've got the Showcase Presents, so this presents all, you know, I haven't read it all because it's 480 pages. But pretty much all of his stories from the 80s and 90s, including a few separate miniseries, and he's actually a pretty interesting character. So he first showed up in two stories in DC Comics Presents in 1982, and effectively at first he was basically just an annoying, almost a supervillain, kind of like Mr. Mitzelplix, got my teeth back in. In his third appearance, he showed up in Supergirl, and he decided, I want to be a hero now. So from that point on, he was a hero. He showed up as a few backup stories in Action Comics, mostly teaming up with Superman. He first discovered Clark Kent as Superman, and then he would tell his origin to the reader. You know, he broke the fourth wall a lot, and he changed, much like the Joker in The Dark Knight, he would change his origin. So one of the version of his origin, he was a mild-mannered guy called Erwin Schwab. He grew up on TV, then got kind of trotted off to Arkham Asylum because everybody thought he was mad. And he kept telling the prisoners that they were the same ones, and it was the staff who were crazy. He eventually got released. He found a costume, and he put it on and had adventures. Another time he told his origin that it was very much like Superman's origin. So he was very aware of Superman's origin. He was saying, oh, no, my real origin is that there was this guy called Brum El on the planet Schwab, and he broke a galactic chain letter. So his planet was doomed to destruction. The last man to break the chain letter was Jor-El on Krypton. So he built this rocket ship, but he didn't want to put himself, his wife, or his baby in the rocket ship, so he put in his favourite, you know, suit. on the way, it got bitten by a radioactive spider and it landed on Earth, and Ambush Bug basically picked it up. His suit, he's a normal human. He puts on this suit. It's basically a green one-piece thing of pyjamas with two orange antennas coming from him. And I guess he's kind of in the mould of the Tick.
Yeah.
I guess the Tick will be another fourth wall-breaking character. I can't recall. But, yeah, basically he just gets up into hijinks. And it's one of those series that only fanboys would get a lot out of. He's breaking the fourth wall all the time. But there are some pretty funny stuff, like his first act as a superhero was he was waiting by a car meter for the parking meter to expire. And then when it does, he basically carries the car and drops it off at the police station. Just weird stuff like that. And then one of the stories, he's jumping around and he's, like, speaking to the letter. And he goes, "Hey, you, letterer, is whoosh the only sound effect you know?" And the next funnel, he's got him jumping with boing. He's going, "That's funny, I've never gone boing before," you know, stuff like that. And then later on in the series, he goes to Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, asks all three of them to be guest stars in the first issue of his solo book. The first issue, there's this big splash page where aliens invade to take our comics. that apparently then it's just referenced where the readers panic and they say, oh, don't worry, it's just a splash page created to sell Ambush Bugs comic. So it's like, I don't know how that works, because you read a comic as a comic, but people panic even though they know it's a comic, and then they complain to DC Comics. But then within the comic itself, they're telling that it's only a comic. It's layer upon layer. It's like a lasagna. But anyway.
Inception.
Yes, pretty much like that. It's like Inception. Eventually, he picks up a psychic, which is basically a toy doll of a baby that someone throws through his apartment window or something. So he picks it up and says, cool, you will be my psychic. He calls him Cheeks, the toy wonder. But then he's a baby doll. He can't talk or anything. He eventually dies after defusing a bomb. And then he realizes that he was only cured because dead heroes sell comics. So it's got lots of little stuff like that. They make fun of DC Comics a lot, like DC Comics logo shows up as a character and just weird things like that. Editor Julius Schwartz, he actually speaks to the writer of the comic inside the comic. So like there's this issue where there's this big giant koala running amok in the city, and Julius Schwartz will say, hey, Keith Giffen, what are you doing about this? You know, get back to the story I paid you to write. Stuff like that. And then he appears as a photo of himself later in the comic, and he's talking to Ambush Bug, and then Ambush Bug goes to meet Death because he's disappointed that he's not included in the next annual crossover the DC do every year. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. So it's very – and it makes fun of not only DC but Marvel and Archie and Ninja Turtles. Riffs on Jack Kirby's art, and there's like little ads in there and – yeah, it's a lot of. I mean, yeah, it's 400 pages, but
it's the kind of thing when you're doing comedy, you have a lot of freedom to throw these ideas in because people take it for granted. You know, once we've had films like Airplane and so forth, you know, people accept this isn't our reality, so you can get away with characters referencing the ads on the next page, and you know, all sorts of things like that. So, and Community, you mentioned before, is another fine example of a show which does something similar, I guess.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting. Like the art style is pretty different from page to page, and yeah, I think if you've been a fanboy a long time, especially DC Comics fanboy, you'll enjoy this. It is very of the 80s and 90s, like. There's a part where they kind of mock Rob Liefeld. We mentioned the pouches and stuff, and there's a big issue there where he's kind of jumping out on the cover. It's called, you know, Bug, number one, big first issue, get into the ground floor, it's now or never. By issue three, you'll be completely lost. Out of my way, I have to appear on 7 different covers at the same time. 7 covers, 14 trading cards, 22 holograms, 28 staples, absolutely no story or characterization whatsoever. And it's all drawn out of Rob Liefeld, kind of X-Force 90s. Style art at the time. But yeah, it's pretty good. The last time Ambush Bug was seen, he's appeared in a few things. I think he appeared in Final Crisis as well. Ambush Bug Year None, which was a 6-issue miniseries in 2008, 2009. Every issue was self-contained. The first issue had to solve the murder of the DC Comics mascot. And then the fourth issue makes a reference to a printing error in the second issue. And then he accidentally kills Dan Didio, who's the editor-in-chief of DC Comics. So more of the same, effectively. It's not laugh-out-loud kind of funny, I guess, but it's the kind of thing that only comics can get away with because they're so self-referential and just such a convoluted history. So I think superhero fans will enjoy it quite a lot. Let's be honest, superhero comics can be mocked. I mean, how many – we did a whole show on superhero parodies, I think, didn't we, at one stage?
I believe this, so, yeah.
This it's such in. A staple of comics that are so – rife and ripe for parody. You know, there's a lot of conventions that you could kind of make fun of and just the seriousness of it all. So Ambush Bug has certainly done that pretty well.
Superhero comics have an obsession with nostalgia, like we mentioned before. So the whole idea of referencing things that you recognize is a pleasure in itself, in a way.
You're like getting in jokes.
Yeah, like you feel part of something when you recognize a reference that Ambush Bug might make. Compared to like an outsider, you feel part of that community, and that's something that superhero comics do well.
True.
As someone who's not a huge fan of them, I can see that appeal definitely.
Yeah. I think one of the ones I just saw in the latest issue of previews was the April issue of The Goon by Eric Power, kind of horror supernatural, very funny, and hopefully the movie comes out soon. Basically, kind of Hellboy but with a sense of humor, I guess, kind of. Go around beating people in a supernatural good time. But, yeah, The Goon is a pretty good comic, and that's kind of not as obvious fourth wall breaking as something like, say, Deadpool or Ambush Bug. But, yeah, The Goon issue 39 comes out in April, and I just looked at the cover, and that's pretty awesome. I'll put it again on the website, but the kind of the description says, in order to compete with the gimmicks and rehashes of the big two superhero companies, Eric Power has decided to completely sell out and relaunch the Goon in the super epic brand new first ever first edition of the 39th issue of the Goon. Not only did the Goon and Frankie get new costumes, but we also discover there are different coloured versions of the Goon. Green Goon, Red Goon, Blue Goon, Purple Goon. What a plot! And the cover has to be seen to be believed. So the last issue I actually read of the Goon was the Goon issue 34, where he's making fun of Twilight. And he basically is just walking out with Frankie, who's his sidekick, from the pub one night, and he finds these sparkling vampires with jazz hands, and they've all got six-packs. So basically he just punches them, and then the Goon turns to the reader and says, you didn't expect me to fight them for 22 pages, did you? That'd be too easy. So a little stuff like that.
I mean, yeah, that sounds like a fun one. I mean, a lot of these comics also kind of play with the conventions of comics, so you won't ever see Batman grab the panel border and smack someone with it. Although you might see that in an early, you know, Winsor McKay comic.
Yes.
I mean, the playing with the actual panel is another trope you see in a lot of these comics. Like in you sometimes you don't even notice it, but occasionally you'll see a wisecracking character like Mitzblitz, blah, 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 whatever. Yes. I can't say it, leaning against the panel border. He's not leaning on anything, but you don't realize it. You know, the characters don't even seem to see that he's interacting with the lines that don't exist in their world. Little things like that. I mean, there's, you know, in Planetary, the way they go to different dimensions is they go into the Bleed, which if anyone's gotten into comic book publishing, the Bleed is the space around the trim, where you trim a page. It's the artwork that goes out past the edge. That's how you get artwork all the way to the edges of the page. So little insider references like that. I mean, Animal Man has an entire chapter which all the narration boxes are just excerpts from the script. So the narration just says, you know, interior, daylight, office room, you know, that kind of thing. And I mean, there's lots of comics we could probably both think of where characters will interact with their word balloons physically. I mean, Joseph Lambert's I Will Bite You has scenes, a whole story where these alien creatures can just kind of grab people's speech balloons and rearrange the word help into something innocuous, you know, so people can't cry for help to escape them and that kind of thing, or bash someone over the head with an exclamation point and that kind of thing. So playing with the conventions of a comic is a very much a meta thing to do. And I can imagine a character like Ambush Bug doing that kind of thing and so forth.
Deadpool's another obvious one. I know when the Marvel versus Capcom 3 game, which I think just came out recently, his Deadpool's special power is that he attacks the other characters with their health bar. So he kind of grabs their health bar and combo bar from the screen and hits them with it.
That's good.
And apparently he, like, makes fun of the player and he, like, rubbishes Capcom and stuff. But, I did want to mention Deadpool. We both thought about him as an obvious one. Deadpool, we know, is kind of co-created by Rob Liefeld in the early 90s. Very popular these days, getting his own film at some point in time, played by Ryan Reynolds in the Wolverine Origins movie. But when he really became popular is when Joe Kelly started to write his first miniature in the 90s, and then Gail Simone did it in the early 2000s. It's a parody of superhero stuff. It's very madcap, and it's the only kind of existing character in superhero comics that breaks the fourth wall. But it's kind of sold as him being insane rather than him being meta, if you know what I mean. Even on covers, sometimes he'll talk to the reader directly. So I've got a few examples, and I'll put the link up to a website that I found that had a few good examples. But there was one example where Bullseye shows up, and Bullseye says, "Hey, Deadpool, when was the last time we saw each other? It's been ages." And Deadpool says, "Issue 16. stuff like that. There's an issue where he's interacting with the caption boxes, you know, like where he says, "Oh, he's glad the caption boxes are back. I remember when I used to think of those little yellow squares." there's an issue where he uses his katana, his sword, to kind of tear back the pages of the comic. He, like, rips the pages of the comic that he's actually standing on to go back 3 pages in the comic and to warn his past self about what's coming in the next page. I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah, that's kind of fun. That's very kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, experimental in a positive way. I like the sound of that. Maybe I'd enjoy this comic, actually.
Yes. The last issue I read actually was in December 2010 featuring Deadpool, and that because that was written by Perth's Shane McCarthy, and that was Deadpool team-up number 886, where he teams up with Iron Fist. And he's a funny character. He's kind of like Spider-Man. He's very witty and quippy and stuff, and I guess because he's pretty much like Wolverine, he's kind of indestructible, so he can afford to be a bit madcap and have a bit of a death wish. But, yeah, there's one where the action cuts back and then Deadpool says, okay, flashback over now, back to the action, little things like that. So you can do it in kind of obvious ways, like I said, tearing through the comic, but even just little ways, like just his narration, being aware that he's in a comic. But, yeah, Deadpool's a pretty interesting character. He's a huge character for Marvel. I mean, he's still around in multiple titles. But they sell it almost like he's insane. You know, he's like this hideously scarred, psychotic hitman mercenary, effectively. So it's not necessarily done as an artistic style.
He gets a family too, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. There's a lady Deadpool and a kid Deadpool and a baby Deadpool or something. I don't know. And there's like a floating head Deadpool. Or I don't know. But yeah, he's a lot of variations of Deadpool.
I've noticed there's a popular leaning now towards having comics be a little bit more self-aware. And you see it especially in, you know, Marvel's Strange Tales or anything where they can say this is non-canon. But characters like MODOK and that kind of thing, they're brought in specifically because fans find them funny. And they're played for laughs rather than for seriousness. And it's not a new thing. I mean, it's the 50s all over again for DC, really, you know, that kind of thing.
But
it's maybe people look for that kind of wink to themselves now and then. Maybe they feel less dirty sometimes. I don't know. But it's becoming more popular, but it's definitely played for laughs predominantly.
Yes.
Yeah. The last example I have here is Cerebus, Dave Sims. Magnum opus, how many, like 3,000 page long, it ran for like 20 years or so forth.
Yeah, something ridiculous.
Yeah, nearly every month, pretty much. I think he missed 1 month or something like that, but just consistent all the time. It's a really fantastic comic. I mean, whatever you've read about Dave Sims' personal politics, at least the two-thirds of the series is completely spectacular. The last third gets bogged down in his political stuff.
Okay.
So if you have trouble with long prose pages, maybe skip those, that's all. But that was always meta and layered early on because it was a satire to begin with. But in the arc called Minds, roughly halfway through the series, Cerebus is kind of launched or absconded into space and he's flying out of control through the solar system, talking to a disembodied voice who we find out is called Dave. Isn't that unusual? And he reveals the secrets of what's going to happen on their world and, you know, the political parties there and so forth. And what Cerebus does, being Cerebus, he's a arrogant cone, like a warrior aardvark. That's a horrible description of him, but but he's like the only animal talking animal character in this comic populated by people. He's a bit like Howard the Duck, there you go.
Yes,
but he demands that Dave make Jaka fall in love with him. Jaka's his longtime object of desire, and Dave instead shows him all possible futures where they end up together, and in all of them they're completely miserable. Either one or the other is, you know, driven to suicide or something, basically because Cerebus is a jerk and Jaka isn't the perfect woman that the comic has set her up to be. You know, she's a person. So it's one where the writer kind of, you can see those are the kind of questions some fans might send in, like, why doesn't Cerebus ever end up with her? And that's almost like, here's why, you idiots. But sometimes it's handled well. And this is much longer than the Grant Morrison talks to Animal Man comic. And because you don't really see Dave, he's just a disembodied talking narration box. It's got a different effect. And this is several hundred pages worth of this conversation. It's really, really interesting conversation, but it's definitely a different kind of comic. And in that one, it's not played for laughs. It's played straight. And it even ends with Cerebus just going, "Ah, just dump me in a bar." So the next volume he spends in a bar. It's a strange one. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of comics which sort of fit the bill of meta, you know, from parody to serious psychological to science fiction, you know, with Planetary. It's a whole world out there.
I'm sure there's a lot that we've missed, you know, like some kind of independent or underground comics that I'm sure were decades ahead of its time that we're not aware of that have been doing it. But
there is one indie webcomic, and I should mention it because you can read it for free online. It's called Supermaker. You can read it at Top Shelf 2.0. That's their online webcomic thing.
Yes.
This is by Andrew Drylon, and it's a short webcomic, and it cracks me up because it's 8 pages long and it's got 3 variant covers. and it's about this young...
Remember this.
That's right. It's about this young comic writer slash illustrator, and he's dying from some kind of terminal disease. And in his last remaining time, he wants to just bash out his great superhero epic, which is like an Infinite Crisis comic, basically, hence the variant covers joke.
Yes.
But so he's secluded himself from his loved ones. He's knuckling down on this comic, and the characters within it are sensing the death of their universe, and they attempt to ascend to the higher dimension and rescue the All Source and save him and the universe by bringing him into theirs. I mean, it's a short, it's only 8 pages long, and it's a nice, quick read, but it kind of encapsulates this meta concept perfectly in a short read. We'll put some pictures on the website.
Nice example. Good work. And yes, and if you have any more that I'm sure we've forgotten about, please email us, Chris with the K at extrasecrets.com, or jump on Facebook and let us know, as always. And thank you for listening. Our previous shows can be seen, well, seen and also heard on iTunes at extrasequential.com.
Yeah, music for the show is at purgeaudit.com. Email Chris at extrasequential with your feedback, as well as hit us up on Facebook with, you know, suggestions for future topics or rants or suggestions. And we've had a couple of good conversations there. And I'm curious what people think about this Spider-Man thing that was raised there. Go to the Facebook thing and tell us what you think about the change of artists and the Spider-Man title. I'm curious, folks. You bastards, tell us what you think.
Yes.
Thanks, everyone, and you'll hear another high-concept topic next week. All right, I'll talk to you next week, Chris, and I can barely wait.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.